Today on Maine Calling, efforts to find common ground. By all measures, America is divided over national issues such as abortion and gun control, and over local issues such as whether to build a new school or ban pesticides. Sure, robust debate is essential to democracy, but this is something more. Angry, entrenched, partisan sides who often consider the other to be evil. All over Maine and the country, groups of people are working to find common ground to bridge this political divide. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with some of those deeply committed to this movement, people trying to find a way out of this hole. But is it even possible? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. People are divided in our nation today over politics, cultural issues, and at work, among family and friends. Today, we're going to hear about some strategies to bridge those divides. Joining me, Lily Hirakova, an associate professor of communication and director of communication education at the University of Maine. Craig Freshley, the author of Together We Decide, and a winner of the American Civic Collaboration Award. And we're hoping to be joined any minute now by Diana McLean-Smith, the author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work to Build a Better Future for Us All. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you been able to overcome a disagreement with a friend or family member? Have you personally worked to overcome some of the cultural divide or the political divide in our state and in the country? If so, we want to hear from you. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you, and hoping to have Diana join soon. A little technical problem there. But, you know, one of the reasons all three of you are invited to be on Maine Calling today is because all of you have done work and are committed to this idea that we can overcome our differences. And I have to be honest, I think that that seems pretty overwhelming in the face of reality right now in America. And so I want to start by just asking you, Craig Freshley, why are you hopeful, given the situation we are in today as a country, why are you hopeful we can overcome our differences and bridge this divide?
Well, hopeful is a big word, Jennifer, and I suppose that I am. But, you know, more than hopeful, I'm going to say it's a necessity. Frankly, for me, it's not a fanciful thing. It's an imperative. We as a society have got to figure out how to overcome our differences. Otherwise, the alternative is pretty bleak, right? It's war, destruction, not only destruction of each other, but our planet. So I think the stakes are very high. I'd love to talk about some hopeful reasons. Maybe we'll leave that for a little later in your show, or see what Lily has to say. But my main point is, I think it's an imperative.
Okay, and then I'll turn to you, Professor. What do you think? I mean, why are you so committed to this work? I think a lot of people have, frankly, raised the right flag.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. I guess, a little correction for my part. I think about not so much overcoming differences as connecting while honoring our differences. I think it's really important to acknowledge all the different backgrounds and experiences that people bring into this world and that there is strength in that, and that we can be a community with differences rather than try to assimilate or flatten those in certain ways. And I guess what gives me hope is really working with students, working with young people, and seeing day in and day out people who come in the classroom scared and uncertain and do leave with friendships in which they can be their own unique and different selves. They can hold different positions, but still be committed to a relationship with one another and to building something together.
Okay, so still recognizing differences, honoring differences, this is not what's happening for the most part in America today. It is amplified during this election year, Craig, but it's not really very different than it was last year or the year before. I know social media, we've done so many programs on this on Maine Calling, and there's so many reasons. Social media is a big part of it because we can go deeper and deeper into our bubbles and not hear what other people have to say. And I'm wondering what your strategies are for pushing back.
Well, for me, it's frankly moving away from social media and talking with each other face to face. It sounds simple, and it's often logistically difficult. We've come very accustomed to talking by Zoom and, of course, by telephone and all kinds of video means. And call me old school if you like, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think there's no substitute for a face-to-face, in-person conversation, especially when we are trying to resolve or overcome our differences. Being able to see each other's facial expressions, reactions in real time, even feel the energy, and all the little things that happen just before a meeting or a conversation, or happen just after a meeting or a conversation, these little things actually make the connections between us. And I totally agree with Dr. Hirokova saying that it's not so much about overcoming connections or overcoming disagreements, it's making connections in spite of our disagreements. And that's where I find hope, and that's what I would say is a leading strategy. And the most effective way to do that is good old-fashioned in-person face-to-face conversation.
Well, both of you have been involved in projects that have tried to tackle this, and I'll start with you, Lily. Tell us about some of the projects and how you conceived of them, who you brought together, and what happened.
Yeah, first, I just really want to follow up on what Craig just said, which I think is, I agree with so much. I think this, you know, it is easy to amplify our divisions in more anonymous spaces, in spaces to fit in our bubbles, on social media, for instance, or even when we are just speaking about ideologies rather than real people. One of the text that repeatedly resonates with young people I work with is a fairly recent book by the Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. The book is called Together, and it focuses on something that has been part of his agenda, and that is understanding loneliness as a public health issue. But one of the things that he does say there repeatedly is that it's hard to hate people up close. And that is a message that really resonates with students. It does make a difference when you share a physical space with somebody, when you can feel their emotions, when you can understand that you need to pause or listen or ask a question rather than shout out statements into the ether. And a project that I have been involved with that is based on this actually turns it kind of speaks of high touch methodologies rather than high tech methodologies is bread houses. And bread houses, they exist internationally. And it's a very simple premise. And that is that bread in some form exists around the world and it nourishes us and it The process of making bread can in some way be a metaphor for the process of people, of communities coming together. So it is not really a cooking class, but the idea is that random people, oftentimes strangers really off the streets, will come together in a space and we'll bring ingredients together into something that nourishes us. We'll wait together for it to ferment. We'll cook it together. Oftentimes we would play with the bread, which is something that culturally a lot of people are discouraged to do, to play with our food. So it's challenging some of those taken for granted cultural norms and seeing how far we can push and what can come out of this. And it's a fun and engaging, non-threatening way for people to experience being next to each other and bringing something together.
Craig, I know that the project that you launched was called Makeshift Coffee House. Tell me about that and tell me if you feel as though it was successful.
Well, thanks for asking about that, Jennifer. It was an impulse that I had when President Trump became elected in 2016. It's not just that my candidate didn't win. I'm a Democrat, and my candidate didn't win. But it's that we were becoming increasingly mean to each other, and the political divide was really starting to become apparent back then. And in response, I booked a meeting room at my local library, and I made a poster. I got some help, actually, and had a meeting. And I asked Democrats and Republicans to come for the sole purpose of understanding each other, not to debate each other, not to try to persuade each other who's right or who's wrong, not to come up with any answers, but simply to understand where each other is coming from. It was a chance to tell stories. I asked people in the room not just what they believe about controversial issues, abortion, immigration, gun control, but I asked them why they believe what they believe so that we could understand how people develop the beliefs that they have. And we come to see that every person has a good reason for what they believe. If I had to state one takeaway from what I learned, I facilitated 40 of those in-person meetings during the Trump years. And it's that the takeaway is that every person has a good reason for what they believe. And when we can start to understand the reasons, then we can start to find the commonalities and we can work together in spite of our different backgrounds, of our different reasons for believing different things.
All right. I want to ask both of you this question, but I'll start with you, Lily. This is all great, and it's nice to try to understand one another. But I believe that many people today believe that people who disagree with them are believing something that's downright dangerous for our country. You know, that both sides believe that democracy is in peril and that this is a really, really dangerous time. And so it's sort of hard to reach out when you are feeling full of fear for your nation.
So much. So much. I relate to this personally. Also, I remember soon after the 2020 election, I was on a sledding hill with my children, and there was another person there who was wearing a pink hat, and the hat said Trump 2024, you know. And I felt like, I don't know, like, if this person hears me speak to my children, as you can hear, I have an accident talk, if that is something that I should be concerned of. I feel that fear in my everyday life as well, a fear of other people. But the truth is that I don't know them, right? I am afraid of what that hat represented, what the idea or the slogan they stand behind possibly represents. And I remember also, again, speaking with my own children and with students, and just calling for not to be brave, but really to be unafraid. I think that, again, as Craig was saying, if we take genuine curiosity and inquire into somebody else's life. Yes, the threats are real, the risks are real, but the possibility to connect and for them to also see me as more human, as less threatening, are there. And that's where the hopeful piece is. But so I think that those political divisions are really real in our daily lives. And I also think at the same time that we have very mundane microscale evidence that we do have multiple ways of coming together. But the divisions are amplified on that macro ideological political scale.
Well, let me ask, if I may, what you did in that situation. Did you say something to the woman next to you? Did you later say, gee, I wish I'd said something to her? I didn't, you know, what happened?
Yes, I debriefed it with people later. In the moment, I didn't say anything. I worked internally. I worked internally to kind of question myself. Why am I afraid? Why is somebody's winter hat scaring me? What does this say about my experiences, about my knowledge? And so I do think some of that work at least is internal, and it's about asking those questions rather than just, you know, assuming that somebody is on the other side, on a different shore altogether, and not wondering about it. I think, you know, Craig mentioned earlier, listening to stories, inquiring and bringing out stories is really important. Having a sense of wonder, I don't think that that's going to solve all the issues. I don't think that that's going to necessarily diminish, again, real threats that are put through legislative means, oftentimes put in place through legislative means. But I do think that wonderment can help us live in a less afraid way.
And Craig, I want to ask you, I think everyone has had a situation where we're chatting with someone, maybe it's a neighbor or we're at a party, and we have this inkling that, oh boy, maybe the person drops something. I've had a situation where somebody said something really ugly about Kamala Harris randomly and out of the blue. We weren't even talking about politics. What do you recommend people do in those moments where somebody says something that surprises you, you disagree with, you find unkind? What do you recommend? Because we all will face that. Unless we're hiding under a rock.
Right. Or even you're at a playground and there's another mom there with a Trump hat. You know, you never know what it could be. When I am my best self, I am not reacting in a negative way. I'm pausing and then I'm asking a question. That is my sort of go-to strategy when I am up against the wall or in a hard place or surprised or shooken and I don't know what to do. I will ask a question in a non-judgmental way. Oh, wow, that's interesting. What made you think of that? Or, oh, that's an interesting view. Can you tell me more about that? Asking a question like that does a couple things. One, it gives me a couple moments to think about how I really want to answer. Is this something that I'm going to confront, or am I going to just keep my head down on this issue, or am I going to engage in a conversation? I get a few moments to consider that. Two, it provides validity to the person. I'm not writing them off. I'm curious about why they believe what they believe or something like that. So I still have rapport with that person. If I react negatively, now I've lost my rapport with that person and we're in a adversarial situation. The third thing it does is it gives me new information. They're going to answer the question and I'm going to get to learn more about them. And I might find something that I can continue a conversation with. That's one strategy, ask a question. Another is to make a comment or to start a conversation totally unrelated to the Trump hat, or totally unrelated to the comment that I just heard you say. But I'm going to strike up a conversation with you about something else, about something that I'm pretty sure we do have in common, like the kids that are playing over there on the swings, or like the food that's in front of us, or like following directions to get to the same place. These are seemingly mundane things, but the trick is to establish something in common right at the start of the conversation. That's going to make me feel better in taking future steps with that conversation. Start with curiosity and see where it goes.
We're talking about finding common ground on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're hearing about ways to bridge the gap when it comes, people come at an issue from very different sides and often very angry sides. My guest today, Craig Freshley, who is a professional meeting facilitator and author of the book Together We Decide, and Lily Harakova, Director of Communication Education at the University of Maine. Share your comments and questions. And, you can call our guests looking for advice or tell us something that worked for you. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to an email here. This is an email from Deb. I have found that patience and respect on social media works with some. Making that extra effort to not respond with hate but calm logic can at least help. I was told by one person that they were shocked and pleasantly surprised when I used this method. Some, of course, will not respond. Thank you, Deb, very much for that. Lily? Hate and calm law. I mean, excuse me. calm logic, hate. Not hate. It doesn't feel very logical out there right now.
Well, I think as we talked about before, when you bring social media in the mix, there is also the element of what remains public or what is intended to be public, because then we're kind of building a persona for not just the immediate person we're interacting with, but for others who may have access to that page. And yes, I think that with that, we also get some emotional amplification. The affordances of social media, whether people would like or repost something like that, seem to sometimes stoke the fire. And we may be seeking even to stoke a fire. I personally have found that when I have had disagreements with somebody on social media, even people with whom we are members of the same group, and in one particular case, this was a kind of a social activism group, and there was a group falling out, but the people that I did care to really kind of continue my relationship with, for whose perspective I deeply cared, even though it was different from mine. We reached out to each other outside of that social media context, again, as Craig was saying. But I think there's a lot of factors to be considered there as well. Are you making extra demands on somebody's time? Are you giving enough room for them to actually say, no, I don't want to engage in this interaction, and to have the capacity to self-determine and self-define what things are for them. To what Craig was saying earlier in terms of responding in the moment, and I think at least social media, maybe that's a good thing. It does give us a little bit of time to think about, to pause, and to be more intentional about what we say and how we react. Though I don't know if everybody takes that time. But there is a sociologist back in the 1960s who proposed this idea of supportive and defensive communication climates, and that our communication actually produces a supportive environment or a defensive environment. And there has been a lot of research on this topic since, and some of those dimensions have changed, but the basics remain kind of the same. A supportive communication would rely on description, on question asking, again, as Craig was saying, rather than on evaluation and trying to control the meaning of the situation. And so when we are our best selves, whether on social media or in person, I think that that exercise of patience, as the listener was saying, would also mean that we can take a breath, consider what's going on, and approach that interaction with more of that supportive orientation rather than the offending or attacking orientation, which is bound to produce defensiveness.
We're going to go to Catherine, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was just recently watching a Twitch stream with a trauma coach that I like, and they went into another stream, and immediately it was just all eagles and American flags, and I was taken aback, and I questioned them on it, and I was eventually banned. And it was just a harrowing experience, and I just wanted to talk about how the American flag has kind of been weaponized. Thank you.
Yeah, and Catherine, let me ask you if you could just, for people who are not hip on social media, what is Twitch? Oh, shoot, I think we've lost her. But I'll turn to you, Craig. Her story of being on a social media discussion board and just expressing her discomfort and being banned and her thoughts about the American flag. What is your response?
Well, it reveals some of the darker qualities of social media. Social media is not a good place to discuss politics or morality or religion. Social media is by and large entertainment, and the people who run the social media platforms just want you to click on more stuff. You know, that's how they sell advertising. I mean, I know that I'm being a little cynical here, but I think it's helpful to put it in perspective and remember and keep in mind social media for what it is, and in that regard, it's got these dark sides, and one is the anonymity factor. We don't have to accept or face consequences for the things that we say and do on social media, like we do when we're in a room with somebody or might bump into them in the parking lot later. And the second thing is the ability to instantly walk away and turn somebody off. I don't like what you're saying, therefore I'm going to unfriend you, I'm going to block you from this conversation, I'm just going to walk away, again, with no consequences at all. And that's what happened to the person who got involved in a conversation about the flag. Somebody else said, you know what, I don't like the things you're saying, so we're just going to lock you out of this conversation. And those are horrible ways to treat each other, really, to not accept any consequences for mean things we say, and to just instantaneously shut people out of conversation. We don't behave that way in real life. Why do we allow ourselves to behave that way on social media? Great for entertainment, but not very good for sowing seeds of civility and actually solving problems. That's my dim view of social media.
Catherine, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Dorothy in Belfast. Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for this program. I just am so glad it's long overdue that we have a frank discussion about the two, as I see it, two political silos where we are suddenly find ourselves in a place where we don't even belong to the same organizations as the opposite party does, and it scares me, quite frankly. But I wanted to call your attention and to your listeners of an organization that has dealt with a difficult problem of connecting people who have a good basis for not liking each other. And that organization is the Restorative Justice Project of the Mid-Coast. We are mostly involved in harm repair, where we can bring a child who did some vandalism or something awful, stole something or whatever, at a young age, we bring them together with the person that he harmed, and we sit in a circle, and we listen. That is the biggest thing, is to listen and establish some common ground and what people's feelings are and how the thing happened and how it can be repaired. I have seen people who were harmed, who had something stolen from them, embrace the kid who did it. So I know what is possible. It also happens, in my experience, among people of different persuasions politically. One time I invited my most severe right-wing and my most severe left-wing people to my house. First, we ate dinner together and had established a common ground. Then we sat in a circle. We had a facilitator. We asked simple questions, not trying to persuade anybody or to argue. We just said, "What, as an American, what are you most afraid of?" And then we said, "And as an American, what gives you the most hope?" Everyone who was at that experience, in that experience, was moved by it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Dorothy, for your call. And I appreciate your perspective. Let's see, we're going to move on to Jennifer, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I firmly believe that a major source of the division between the political factions in our country is can be found right at right-wing conservative talk radio. If you have never listened to it, you really should avail yourself of it, and you would see they harangue, and when you in turn speak with someone from the right wing about a particular issue, they regurgitate exactly what was said on talk radio. There's little thought and just repeating what Sean Hannity and that ilk had to say.
Jennifer, thanks for your call. Lily, you are a professor of communication. What do you think? Is right-wing talk radio the reason or a symptom? Where does it fall?
I like how you put it, the reason or a symptom. I think that it is more of an indication of where people would like to be. And it's not really, it's not only the right wing. It is this necessity to pick a side. It is seeing coming to the space between as a weakness of conviction. And
so you would say the same thing about people who listen or watch liberal television or radio?
Well, it could be. I mean, the audiences have agency, right? We are all active participants in this media environment. So I don't think it's really a linear thing. Here is what the media one way or another says. Here is what people believe. People are active participants in that. And we do have groups and communities that could help us question these messages, help us gain perspective, or ones that help us stay and become more entrenched. I mentioned earlier that book by Dr. Vivek Murthy, Together. One of his claims there is that there is a psychological process that goes with feeling lonely, with feeling alone. And that is a process that produces more necessity to protect oneself, more movement towards that entrenchment. It becomes harder to seek those connections, and it feels safer, as much as we know it might be just one perspective, to stay with what we think is true for us. So his prescription, obviously, and he does tell a lot of great stories for just kind of on the ground ways in which people have sought connection.
Yeah. I'm so glad, Jennifer, you brought up the media, even though you were talking about radio. I'm going to talk a minute about television. We've had similar programs before, and I'm surprised no one's said this yet, but a lot of people will say, you know, it's Fox News. And I'm curious, Craig, about your thought, because, you know, on a good night, Fox News has 2 million viewers. There are 330 million people in America. So my inexpert view is that it's a little too facile to blame something on something like Fox News, to blame the entire cultural divide in our country and the anger in our country on one media outlet or even a handful of media outlets.
of course, there's a temptation to blame it on social media, to blame it on Fox News, to blame it on conservative radio, to blame it on President Trump. But it's never that simple. There is a lot going on. And I would offer that a quote that I heard in one of these conversations, one of these makeshift coffee houses that I facilitated between Democrats and Republicans. And we were talking about social media and all the media, professional media, and how it's a scary time. There is scary news coming at us, probably like never before. I mean, we as a generation of people get hit with such a volume of bad news about the world, climate change, political instability, famine and refugees. And it's confusing and it's stressful. And at one of these makeshift coffee houses, somebody said, you know, I just want to pick something. I just want to pick something to believe in, something that I know is going to be unchanging and that I can count on. And this person was talking about picking a certain political leader or a certain political ideology, and even to the point of, don't confuse me with the facts. This works for me. I want to believe in this ideal. It's simple. Okay, this is my belief structure now. I'm done with everything else. And it stayed with me, that comment. And I think that a lot of what we're experiencing in America is people shutting down, withdrawing from mainstream politics and civic affairs in general, being too confused and stressed out about knowing what to do about climate change or the political divide and all of these other problems, and picking a simple belief system and just going with that, and actually shut down to debate, conversation, open to new ideas. I'm being cynical, I know, and I'm not trying to paint a picture of the majority, but I think there's many
people. Well, and to Jennifer's point, if people are feeling fearful, are feeling frustrated, are feeling like they don't have agency, and they do listen to a certain radio station or watch a certain TV station, maybe it gives them talking points and some comfort that they're not alone.
Thanks for saying that so well.
We are going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about trying to find common ground. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, our show today about efforts and strategies to bring people together. Joining me, Craig Freshley, the author of Together We Decide. He's a meeting facilitator. And also Lily Hirakova, who is Director of Communication Education at the University of Maine. If you'd like to take part in our conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. You might get through. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. An email here from Doug. Our national organization, Braver Angels, has a Maine chapter, and we teach free skills to help people engage with family members and others with different political views. Check out braverangels.org and take a free workshop and connect with other involved Mainers. And then he writes, P.S., I'm writing a book, Beyond the Politics of Contempt, Practical Steps You Can Take to Make Our Country Better. And have a quote in there from one of your past shows. Hope and despair are interlinked in almost every way. Being human is holding on to both at the same time. And Brittany Longstorff, who's the Bates College chaplain, said that on Maine Calling. So, Doug, thank you so much for that. And, Craig, you know this organization, Braver Angels?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're a national organization. And as the email writer said, they have a Maine chapter called Building Bridges. They have a program coming up, actually, on regulation. Whether we should have more regulation or less regulation. I think it's going to be on Monday. I don't have it handy. I'm sorry, but I hope you'll look it up. It's called Building Bridges.
Great. And Lily, you know Braver Angels as well.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thanks, Craig, for this information.
Tom in Booth Bay Harbor, go ahead.
A couple of years ago, my wife and I decided to try an experiment. We had a sign made, and we get posted in the ground next to our door. And whenever we host a party, a cookout, we just had a mini high school class reunion, and the sign says, "You are now entering a politics-free zone." It's really remarkable how refreshing it is when people come in and they can take the burden off their shoulder. There won't be tension in the room. It's a wonderful and you know, simple method to kind of keep everything on the up and up.
You know, Tom, thank you for that. And it reminds me, Craig, you know, people used to say, don't talk about politics or religion. And what happened to that?
I don't know what to say about that. I think if you want to have a no politics zone, I think that's great. And if that helps, that's fine. On the other hand, there are people eager to talk about politics, and we should not dissuade such efforts. But it is true that we don't seem to talk as easily about politics across divides as we used to. I don't know, maybe I'm making that up or romancing or something.
Tom, thanks for calling.
Sometimes if people talk about issues that concern them, that are really part of their lives, that are political, almost everything is political. And if there is a distinction between addressing that, how do we address healthcare? A lot of conversations in our communities here are around unhoused people. And so I guess a question I wonder is when there is this rule about no religion or politics, what about the issues of daily life that are part of the life that we're living? Are those excluded from that rule?
So there you go, Tom. You say no politics, but can people in your parties, can they talk about, say, the debate over the beach in your town and who should have access? Or can they talk about, you're in Boothbay Harbor, the debate over how many short-term rentals should be allowed?
Well, I guess if they want to take it, you know, out near the bushes, they could talk about, you know, whatever they want to talk about. But it has kept together a group of people that may have been splintered apart because politics have become too open these days.
Okay, so it's not just politics in terms of elections, it's everything. Thanks so much for calling in. We have so many calls coming in. I'm going to go to Brian in Brunswick. Hi, Brian, go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer, for having me, and thanks to Lily and my friend Craig Freshley for this program. Number one, I spent 35 years working in Latin America and have watched democracies flip to dictatorships almost overnight. And I fear that we are in that perilous position today in the United States. So everyone should pay attention and vote. Secondly, I moved to Maine after 18 years in the Adirondack region and was honored to be a co-founder of what we now call the Common Ground Alliance. Environmentalists, we're not talking to town supervisors and we're not talking to economic development people. A friend brought three of us together and I asked, what are we here for? And she drew a Venn diagram with three words, community, economy, environment. And the rules of that game were to invite people to come to the table with solutions that would benefit communities, their economies, and the environment, not to come with complaints about what was wrong. That movement has grown from three of us back in 2004 to well over 450 people today who take an agenda to Albany, New York, and the legislators, and some of whom once said the 6 million acre Adirondack Park would rather fight than win. Now, those people now have a political force and a political voice because they've got solutions. And I believe that's what our two parties need today. I'm not sure we'll get there, but I pray for the best. Thank you.
Brian, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on to David calling from Penobscot. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a question for Craig. I've attended a couple of makeshift coffee houses and had really good discussions there. But in both cases, I would say 80 to 90% of the people there define themselves as liberal and only 10 to 20% as conservative. And similarly, I have tried to participate in a couple of Braver Angel events, And I am left-leaning myself. And what I found out was that I couldn't participate because they had an overabundance of left-leaning people and not enough right-leaning people. So my question is, I mean, I believe these cross-party divide discussions are really important, but they're not going to be very productive if most or almost all of the people there are represent one side of the issue. What strategies can you offer to bring more people who are conservative leaning to these conversations?
David, thanks for that question. Craig?
It's a great question, and it was a considerably challenge when I was running the makeshift coffee houses, and it is today to bring conservative perspectives to these conversations. A couple things. One is frame the invitation not only as an opportunity to listen to the other side, but as a chance to be heard. I think that a lot of conservative voices feel unheard and misunderstood, and maybe even unappreciated, not fully understood. And so offering an opportunity like this as a chance to explain where you're coming from and you tell us why you believe what you believe can be an incentive. And it's the old strategy, another one, is to get a few champions. You know, there are conservatives and Republicans, of course, who do want to talk across the divide and who are opened to differing ideas and who want to work in a nonpartisan way. Ask those people to be the leaders and ask other conservatives to join the conversation. I learned that it works much better when a Republican asks a Republican to join a conversation than it does when I ask a Republican to join a conversation. So that's another bit of a practical strategy. But I also want to point out that, you know what, a lot of people don't want to have that conversation. And I have learned to, for lack of a better way to say it, given up on those people. If you don't even want to talk, if you have closed your mind to hearing why someone else believes what they believe, then there's not much I can do about that as a facilitator. And I'm going to move on and try to help the people that do want to understand each other and learn new things.
David, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to an email from Bruce. Bruce writes, Americans are lazy. We've become comfortable with ingesting information that we do not fact check, and then we regurgitate it. If someone from the left or right starts up with me, spouting the propaganda from their viewpoint, I tell them to change the channel from time to time. Most Mainers, maybe as many as 60% of us, are really independent at heart. If a candidate came along from either party who made sense to us, that person would win the state in a walk. And I actually think this is a great sort of final point to discuss. And I'll go to you, Lily. You know, Bruce makes the point that, you know, Maine is in some ways a little different from the rest of the nation in that such a large percentage of Mainers are either registered as independents or consider themselves moderate Republicans or conservative Democrats. Is this a place to start? Instead of what Craig says, you know, working on people who are locked in, work on those people who our emailer believes is the majority who are in the middle.
Or excite the sides of all of us who are in the middle, who are willing to, again, wonder, be curious about different positions. I do think that fundamentally we start off as, you know, as beings who experience the world around us in interactions with that world. And at some point it becomes more comfortable, it becomes safer to say, like, here is who I am, and hold on to the narrow definitions of that identity, forgetting that, again, our fundamental way of connecting with those around us and with the broader world is through inquiry and curiosity that is not only about the other, but by being about the other, it is also about ourselves. So yes, I do think Maine is a place where those interactions perhaps could be easier to initiate, but I also think that they are possible any place. And it is really a matter of how we orient ourselves to one another. If we orient ourselves to one another with a commitment to a place, I think earlier I had shared with some of you that one of the most inspirational books that I find is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And there she poses the question of what does it mean to live as if you're staying? To live as if you're staying in a place with commitment to that place, to the people who are there. We may have all come from someplace else. We may have all held different views. But what would it mean to live staying together?
Well, beautiful last thing to say. And I appreciate both of you. Lily Karakova, an associate professor of communication at UMaine. Craig Freshley, the author of Together We Decide. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Take a moment to download the Maine Public Vox Pop app. That's a way you can take part in upcoming programs. And you can learn about those when you subscribe to our free weekly newsletter, which you can subscribe to at mainecalling.org. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.